Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, international activists will start dropping in. They'll be taking us inside China's jails. What it's like, who's imprisoned there, and how they're treated. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and I'm joined today by Dr. Yung Jun Lee, a champion of free speech, civil society, and non-violent action who spent 5 years in China's jails. Our focus today is on political prisoners, prisoners of conscience in prison because of what they believe or say. Dr. Yung, I'd like to talk with you in detail about how you came to be arrested later in the program, but first, let's go straight into China's jails. Take us into the prison you first went to. Show us around a bit.
I went to China in 2002 to support a labor movement there. But 2 weeks after I managed to enter China, I got arrested. And I was detained in Kunming, which is capital city of Yunnan province in the southern part of China. I was detained there for 12 days and transferred to Beijing, where I was put in Qincheng prison. And I was put in solitary confinement for nearly 15 months without anyone to talk to except for police officials, and without books to read, with no outside news, and constantly subjected to psychological and physical torture.
So let's go through those things one thing at a time. Tell us about your cell. What was it like and how much light was there?
Oh, it's a very small cell with a very high small window and a toilet in the corner of the cell. There was no bed, only a hardboard. And I slept on the hardboard every night and I got up very early. And during this time, they had more than 120 interrogations, and I wasn't allowed to go out for fresh air and sunshine. I was forced to sit straight without moving for 4 hours a day.
You were put in solitary confinement. Was that a standard practice, or was that because of something that followed you into the prison through your arrest?
It is not a standard practice. They put me in solitary confinement simply because my case was high profile and I had been blacklisted by Chinese government for 13 years since 1989 when the Tiananmen Square massacre took place. I had been deeply involved with the democracy movement overseas and helped my colleagues back in China with a lot of projects. So I was very well known to many people, including the Chinese authorities.
Yes, let's refresh our friend's memory about Tiananmen Square back in 1989. What happened and how did you find yourself in the United States?
In April and May of 1989, students in Beijing took to the street protest against government corruption and demanding for democratization. I was a graduate student at University of California at that time, and I was elected by my fellow Chinese student in the university to go back to support the students who were protesting in Beijing. And also I brought back money to support their activities. The money was collected before I went. and I got involved with many activities in Beijing, and I witnessed the massacre. Nobody knows for sure how many people were killed, but I had a rough estimation of thousands of them. In the aftermath of a Tiananmen massacre, there were many, many activists who were executed across the country. So altogether, I think it is safe to say thousands of protesters were killed.
You would have had a lot of time to contemplate and think while you were in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
Why do you think that you were kept in solitary confinement during that time?
I believed, as I believe today, I was put in solitary confinement because my case was very politically sensitive. They just do not want any news get out, letting other people know that I was kept in the prison. You know, the authorities did not give any notice to my family member where I was detained and for what reason I was detained, as they should according to Chinese law. So they intentionally not let any people know where I was detained for over a year.
Your family must have been beside yourself by not knowing where you were during that time. It's always difficult for people whose loved ones are in prison, even more difficult in China, where there's a special stigma attached to the people who are outside prison with loved ones inside. Let's talk about the dissidents who are in Chinese jails at the moment. How many prisoners of conscience like you are presently in China's prisons?
Again, it's difficult to know for sure how many political prisoners are imprisoned in China now. You know, it's always difficult to find numbers in China. A lot of them were put in education labor camp without due process. That means their cases are off records. And local authorities can and do put dissidents in prison. And even the central government does not have a record of what's going on in certain area with local government. So it's extremely difficult to figure out how many political prisoners are imprisoned at the present time. Again, I have a rough estimation. It's safe to say that there are thousands of them.
And what kind of crimes have they committed? What does the Chinese authorities say they have done that justifies their detention?
They were imprisoned for no other reason than that they tried to exercise their basic rights to speak freely, to assemble freely. And most cases involve protest. Most of them are leaders, organizers of a protest. And some journalists who revealed the government to conduct evil business, and also some scholars who constantly publish articles criticize the Chinese government and challenge their rule. And some lawyers, human rights lawyers, who helped many individual cases fighting against the authorities who violate people's basic rights.
The people that you've just been describing, are they treated differently to other criminals in jail? For instance, people who might have killed somebody or committed an armed robbery, is the treatment they receive in jail different or the same as common criminals?
The treatment are pretty much the same. How the prison authorities treat you largely depends on how much you can bribe, and also depends on whether you have strong background. If you have some association with a powerful person in the government, you would be treated well, better than others. And for political prisoners, the treatment varies from case to case. It's really difficult to define a pattern. Some political prisoners were treated with respect, without torture, but others are treated very badly, with brutal torture, both physical and psychological.
over in Boston, where your family was, how did you maintain contact and what happened to them while you were in jail?
They were very, very worried and scared because they did not know what happened to me. They did not even know where I was detained, for what reason, and what crime they will charge me. And my wife tried to go back to China to find out what's going on, but she was blocked at Beijing airport. And my brother retired. He got early retired simply because the whole family needed him to go to Beijing to find me. He went to Beijing many times to ask around, trying to locate me. So it was devastating to the whole family.
And so what did they do while you were in jail? You were in jail for 5 years. They found out that you were in jail after a year. What were they able to do for you across the world?
My wife worked tirelessly to lobby the U.S. government for it to advocate on my freedom. She lobbied all the way to White House. President Bush raised up my case to his Chinese counterpart many times. Secretary Condoleezza Rice raised my case when they engaged in talks with Chinese counterparts. And the U.S. Congress passed a resolution requesting my unconditional and immediate release, which exerted a tremendous pressure on the Chinese government. So otherwise, I would be sentenced to a much longer term. If they had been in Beijing, they would have very limited resources to use to work on my case, as what's happening to Hu Jia's family and Qin Guangcheng's family and the family members of many dissidents in China.
Yes, the difficult lives waiting the partners of political prisoners sent to jail was highlighted at the end of 2007 by the China Rights Forum, an excellent magazine published by the NGO Human Rights in China. In it, Ouyang Xiaorong writes this essay called The Life of a Political Prisoner's Wife.
Ouyang Yu is a political prisoner. He's my second eldest brother. Luo Bizhen is his wife. When Ouyang Yu was made a political prisoner, people did not bring him water and bread. Instead, they wanted to gather around and get a look at these red hair, green eye, counter-revolutionaries, male and female. Chinese treat decapitations as passing entertainment, no matter whether the head that falls is of the flesh or of the spirit. In 2006, towards the end of winter, I met Luo Bizhen. She was wearing simple winter clothes that made no attempt at stylishness. When we were introduced, she just smiled. Compared to her, I was just a kid, but she was shyer than I was. You could not tell that she was the wife of a political prisoner. That because she had fallen in love with this man, she now suffered all life's grief with him. You could not see her distress. She faced everything with composure. Struggling on the edge of poverty, drifting from place to place with no improvement in sight. But if she harbored complaints against life, it did not show. We shouldn't ask what kind of world this is. We live in this world and that is enough. It is beautiful. Luo Bizhen teaches in a rural school, returning on weekends to her home in the city of Suining in Anhui province. She and Ouyang Yu used to teach together, but he lost his position long ago. Now he just stays home and writes, earning a little money from his manuscripts. When Ouyang Yu was driven out of the school where he taught, Luo Bizhen was driven out too. The reason given was very simple. Who made you marry a counter-revolutionary? That makes you one too. We don't want you here anymore. Untold hardships followed until finally she found another teaching job in the countryside. Through all the changes of the years that followed, she kept to her little town of Suining, kept to her child, who was hurt and humiliated, and kept to her storm-battered husband. I think she's fortunate because she loves and is loved. The wives of political prisoners are a special group, not political prisoners themselves. They choose to suffer alongside political prisoners. Geng He is a handsome woman, but when a person has been immersed in terror, the most pleasant-looking amongst us takes on a frightening look. I have seen a picture of her, eyes wide and staring, like someone who has just stopped weeping. She does not even note down the license plate of the car of the secret policeman who beat her. Her husband Gao Zizhen told her, no use looking, it just flatters him. So she never looks at their car. When the state security came to take away her husband, they came with all kinds of men and vehicles. It was an attempt to isolate her whole family, young and old, from society. After that, state security officials came to beat her. Two tall, strapping men beating one woman, shouting accusation at her, Geng He, you injured two policemen! Where is the justice in that? If Geng He had been able to injure two big strapping men, then she would not be Geng He. She would be an Olympic judo champion like Sun Fuming. Later, state security beat her 13-year-old daughter, shouting as they struck her that she was a little whore. Geng He was filled with sorrow, but she bore it as before. This was a choice, and when you make a choice, you stick with it. When you decide to become a political prisoner, you have to be ready to bear the crushing instruments of tyranny, along with the humiliations on every side. This is the tactic of the most terrifying tyrant in Chinese history. Mao Zedong knew this. His tactic was bring them down and dishonor them. When this happens to political prisoners, it is because they have convictions, a vision of transforming society. But it is different for wives of political prisoners who accompany their husbands into hardship solely out of love. I believe that there really is something called love in this world, even though so many people are always telling me there is no such thing. The moment I met Fang Zhao, I was that much closer to knowing this thing I believed in. And my belief that it not only existed, but could be sought and obtained, was that much stronger. What is more, I believe that by relying on love, one can fight back at this absurd world. Examples are right in front of you. Wives of political prisoners are a special group. Not political prisoners themselves, they choose to suffer along with political prisoners. Fang Zhao is a typical northerner, married to a man much older than herself, a political prisoner with a daughter. This political prisoner has no money, no house. The reason she married him is simple. Here's what she says. People in the democracy movement are noble and upstanding. So the reason she fell in love with an impoverished democracy activist was because of her own strong belief in his qualities. For that, she willingly bore it all. She and her daughters live in a roughly finished house in a slum on the outskirts of Bengbu in Anhui province. To get there, you have to traverse a filthy, muddy road whose ditches are filled with rotting fruit paring, vegetables and other garbage. I grew up reading foreign literature, and I know that in the old days in the West, when winter came, vagrants would commit crimes so that they could spend the cold weather in prison, where it was warm and there was food and drink. But this would never work in China. When somebody does time in China, the family has to pay. They even have to buy the bullets for the firing squad. With her husband in jail, Fang Zhao had to spend 400 yuan a month, a sum she and her daughter did not even spend on the outside. She was allowed to visit her husband once a month for about an hour each time. She says, at first I went happily, but every time, as soon as I got there, I started to cry. I couldn't help it. He'll say, be strong. And I'll say, I'm not crying because I'm not strong. It's because when I see you, I can't help it. Every time she goes to the prison, Fang Zhao buys a lot of fruit because her husband is fond of it. She buys fruit she and her daughters cannot afford to eat. She buys dozens of pounds of it at once, though she has to change buses, carry her daughter, and all that fruit as she travels to faraway Tongling prison. Her husband says to her, "What do you bring all this for? I'm fine here. You need the money at home." She says, "I can make more money, but I can only come to see you once a month." Fang Zhao is like a woman in a beautiful poem, someone say. Yes, she's like her name. Without great women, there would be no great men. In the Tsarist prison in Russia, political prisoners had the respect of the other prisoners. The convicts would not let them work, and so they did the heavy task themselves. You could not imagine this happening in Chinese prisons. I cherish a tiny wish, or maybe I should call it a great hope. Whenever the sun sets in the West, I pray that political prisoners in China might receive the same treatment as they did in Russia. I pray this because my friend Hu Xia faces the danger of being imprisoned at any time. Could he, with his frail, sickly physique, stand up to that inhuman place?
That was Lee Tan from the Australian Conservation Foundation reading extracts from an essay by Ouyang Xiaorong called The Life of a Political Prisoner's Wife, broadcast with the permission of the China Rights Forum, the magazine in which it first appeared. Listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And today we're talking with Dr. Yung Jun Lee, who in 2002 was catapulted from his home in Boston into a Chinese jail. So let's turn now to the reasons why you found yourself in a Chinese jail for 5 years. First, some background. Civil unrest is rising in China, particularly in rural areas where people are increasingly disgruntled by corrupt or inefficient officials. It's something many people are saying is a push upwards by the people to claim freedom of speech and demand a right to be heard. You're a non-violent activist, now living in the United States. How did you come to be in China to begin with?
When the labor movement broke out in early 2002, some of the leaders in northern eastern part of China, they contacted me for strategies, non-violent strategies, and they also want ideas on how to organize the protest and make their demands. So I was in such a contact with them for some time. Something very important was happening in China. That turned out to be the beginning of rights protection movement. So I went back to join them and support them, especially I did not want to see the movement developed into violence.
So let's go to the offence that you officially committed to justify 5 years in jail. It wasn't actually talking with labour activists, was it?
No. They charged me with illegal border crossing and espionage, which was obviously groundless.
When you were brought inside prison, were you tortured there?
Yes, as I told you, I was forced to sit straight without moving for hours a day. And I was beaten once, and I was handcuffed continuously for 15 days. And I wasn't allowed to go out for fresh air and sunshine for nearly 8 months. I think even though I suffered at the hands of the Chinese authority very much, common criminals would suffer much, much more.
When we say common criminals, we mean people who have been in prison because they've committed crimes of violence or crimes of property or...
Yeah.
And they are tortured.
They are tortured much, much more than the prison authorities torture political prisoners.
And for what purpose?
That's a culture of Chinese prisons. they tend to believe these people are bad and do not deserve any respect. So they can do whatever they want to them.
Absolutely frightening for those involved. You were interrogated around 120 times, as you told us, while you were in jail. What did your interrogators want to know?
Everything was designed carefully, sometimes intense talk, sometimes just casual conversation. But the purpose did not change. That was for information and for confession.
Yes, you're now practiced in interrogation after that length of time with interrogators. What tips do you have for those who might find themselves in a similar situation?
The measure they used the most was psychological. You know, they may scare you by saying, oh, you would stay here forever. And sometimes they hinted that your family members are in a very bad situation. Once, for example, they hinted that my wife and my 6-year-old son had been taken into custody by them.
Really?
Yeah, they just use measures like that to try to make you collapse.
And even though you might not have believed it, there would have been a lingering doubt in your mind that you were unable to clarify. How do you maintain strength in that situation?
Oh, it was very difficult. I almost collapsed. If you were weak, you would easily fall into the trap.
Well, so far we've been shining a spotlight on the experience of Chinese people in prison because they're trying to build alternatives to the Chinese Communist Party's monopoly on political power. The other political action guaranteed to get the Chinese Communist Party hopping mad is ethnic minorities demanding more freedom within its country borders, like the demonstrations we're seeing in Tibet. But while we're hearing a lot about what's happening in Tibet, spare a thought for its neighbour, Xinjiang. Like Tibet, it's presently claimed by China as a province in its far west region, and also like Tibet, its people are seeking more autonomy and have been brutally repressed in the process. But, unlike Tibet, their cause is rarely heard on the international stage. Alim Setoff is the director of the Uyghur Human Rights Project and general secretary of the Uyghur American Association. What claim do the Uyghur people have on independence from China, Alim Setoff?
Historically, East Turkestan, like Tibet, was an independent state. It was not part of China. And the first time it was occupied by the Manchu Qing dynasty, the people who occupied China and colonized China, in 1884. The Manchus then changed the name of East Turkestan into Xinjiang. In Chinese, means new territory. The Uyghurs fought against the Manchus many times for many years, later declared independence at the end of the 19th century. Then the Manchus came reoccupied. Then in 1933 and 1944, Uyghurs twice declared independence and kicked out the Chinese later nationalist forces, Chinese militarists basically. But in 1949, Soviet Union under Stalin cooperated with Mao Zedong and basically betrayed the Uyghurs' independence and forced the Uyghur political leadership to negotiate with Mao Zedong regarding the status of East Turkestan. Then the Soviets and the Chinese claimed that the plane exploded, killed all the ministers. Then the Chinese Red Army moved in and took over East Turkestan in October 1949. Then 5 years later, in 1955, East Turkestan was officially declared as a Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region by the Chinese government. Then since then, we lost our independence, sovereignty and everything. So we were forcibly incorporated into People's Republic of China.
Now, this term autonomous region is used by China in a number of areas, isn't it? It's used for Tibet, it's used for Taiwan. What does it mean?
In international law, it means self-rule within a country. Basically, you run your own business as a separate people, and only national defense and diplomacy is basically delegated to the central government. But all the other issues, whether cultural, economic, education, are run by the people. But in China, autonomy is nothing. It means absolutely nothing. And it's only on the paper. Mm. If you read China's the constitution, China's autonomy law, and it states so beautifully of the rights of the minorities who hold this autonomy. But in fact, absolutely nothing is implemented. And it's run by the central government. Actually, autonomy has become a noose to hang the Uyghurs and Tibetans.
Yes, it's actually quite confusing for the international community, isn't it? Because the name implies that you do have autonomy. What are the Uyghur people doing at the moment to resist the Chinese rule?
In East Turkestan, the Uyghurs are doing absolutely nothing. Not because they don't want to do anything to oppose the Chinese rule, but because of the severe repression on the part of the Chinese government. Especially after 9/11, the Chinese authorities began to brand even peaceful Uyghurs as terrorists and began to widely arrest, torture, and execute a number of Uyghurs. And also China used Olympics as another opportunity to justify its stepped-up persecution of Uyghurs. So if you ask an ordinary Uyghur on the street whether he wants to live under Chinese rule or rather live in an independent country, I think the person most likely would like to live in an independent country because the Uyghurs are not happy under Chinese rule at all since 1949. All they faced is religious persecution, political repression, economic deprivation, and basically the Uyghur people have been successfully reduced to second-class citizens by the Chinese authorities. Today in East Turkestan, the situation is like a police state. You will see Chinese soldiers, Chinese security forces patrolling Uyghur neighborhoods, Uyghur markets, and where Uyghurs are the majority. You wouldn't see them patrolling the Chinese streets or Chinese neighborhoods with German shepherds. And so the Uyghurs are terrified. Basically, the Chinese state is terrorizing the Uyghur people into silence. So whenever several Uyghurs, young people, when they get together, even in one neighborhood, we see the Chinese security forces, plainclothes. They come in with a van and they round up these Uyghurs and beat them up really bad, detain them several days, let them go. And everybody is so scared and nobody dares to do anything to resist at the moment. Of course, the more the repression, the more the resistance we see. At the end of March, we learned that some 2,000 Uyghur women in the city of Hotan, they took to the streets to protest against Chinese government's religious repression and also in support of Tibet. And they were immediately cracked down by the Chinese security forces. We have learned 600 of these young ladies have been arrested by the Chinese authorities. Maybe even more than 600 women have been arrested. So the situation is very tense. Chinese security forces are everywhere and people live in terror.
Alim Setov, do we know how many Uyghur resistors are arrested or jailed at the moment?
At the moment, we don't have a specific figure.
Right.
And when Ms. Rabia Kadir was in prison, the prison was a ladies' prison.
Rabia Kadir being a very well-known Uyghur woman who was imprisoned and has now been released and is on the international stage advocating for the Uyghur people.
Right. The Chinese authorities imprisoned her for nearly 6 years for trying to meet with a member of the U.S. Congress who was visiting, actually, our capital city, Urumqi. And the Chinese government accused her of revealing so-called state secrets at a closed trial, which lasted for a couple of minutes, and sentenced her to 8 years in prison. The first 2 years, she was locked up at a solitary confinement. Then later, she was brought up to a cell with a window. And it was a women's prison. She said there were several thousand women in that prison, and majority of those were Uyghur women. And it is extremely hard to find out how many Uyghurs are being arrested and imprisoned by the Chinese authorities. But many Uyghurs estimate it may be well over 100,000.
In jail at the moment?
Yes.
That's a huge amount. And executions, is that something that Uyghur people face the risk of?
Yes, the Chinese authorities mostly execute Uyghurs for nonviolent political and religious offenses. And China randomly executes Tibetans. China never executes Chinese dissidents.
When you say religious, the East Turkestan people were Muslim. And
yes.
And that's one of the reasons why China is able to set them up internationally under that panicky title of terrorism.
Right. And after 9/11, the Chinese government decided to use that as a golden opportunity to justify colonization of East Turkestan and the repression of the Uyghur people, which was unjustifiable until 9/11. And after 9/11, if you are Muslim and if you have a problem with the government, even with the most repressive authoritarian government like China, you can be easily demonized as a terrorist. And so the Chinese government began to all of a sudden claim itself a victim of so-called Uyghur terrorism, the country that has been terrorizing Uyghurs for the last half a century, and then began to portray any Uyghur who was not happy with the authorities as a splittist, religious extremist, and a terrorist.
Mm.
So these are the charges and labels the Chinese authorities use to arrest, torture, and execute Uyghurs.
Yes, it's a common ploy, isn't it, internationally? There's a number of governments around the world that are using that ploy to actually get funding and international support for fighting against people who are claiming independence within their own boundaries.
Yes.
I'm wondering, though, we hear much more about what's happening in Tibet than we do about what's happening in Xinjiang. How come?
Well, the reason is Dalai Lama, His Holiness, were able to flee from Chinese persecution to India, and the base is government in exile there so that he could promote the cause of the Tibetans in the Western world, in the rest of the world. Whereas, as I explained earlier, our president and all the government ministers were killed in a so-called plane crash. Then after that, the Chinese Red Army moved in and rounded up other Uyghur leaders, killed one after another. So the Uyghurs' political leaders were not able to flee to another friendly country like India and lobby and advocate for the freedom of the Uyghur people. So we were far behind Tibetans in terms of raising our situation in the West. We were only able to raise it after the 1990s. And that's why there is little international awareness of the situation. As a result, there is little attention. But after the release of Mr. Abdelkadir in March 2005, we have been able to promote and raise awareness around the world aggressively, informing the international community.
Well, good luck with that struggle. Alim Setoff is the director of the Uyghur Human Rights Project and General Secretary of the Uyghur American Association. Alim Setoff, for the new internationalists that are listening to the program today, where can they go to find out more about the Uyghur people and their struggle?
Visit our website. It is www.UyghurHumanRightsProject.org. And also could go to Uyghur American Association website, which is uygheramerican.org. Or just Google the Uyghur name, UYGHUR.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. Bye for now and speak to you soon.
All right.
Thank you.
That was Bob Brosman performing International Tango on his latest CD, Lumiere. More details about that later in the program. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're taking a walk through China's prisons with Dr. Yong Jun Li, a political prisoner who spent 5 years within their walls. Dr. Yong, I understand that Chinese prison authorities encourage you and others to help share your knowledge in prison with those less educated. In what way did that happen?
That is not encouraged, but it happened naturally in that way. When people are kept together, some have a higher education than others, so they automatically organize themselves in exchange programs. People with higher education teach those with a lower education. The student will pay something to teachers. That's automatically organized the exchange program in prison. My case was different. You know, I offered courses to my inmates without asking for anything. I taught mathematics, English, economics, and I wrote textbook on logics, and I taught the inmates Chinese calligraphy, and I also coached a basketball team. So I did this because I want to get to know the inmates and make them my friends, and in that way I can influence them with my ideas to change China. Actually, that was very successful. And many inmates and some guards became friends of mine, very supportive, sympathetic to what I did.
So to do that, to share knowledge about political systems, to help share knowledge about calligraphy, language and logic, there must be some tolerance by prison authorities and guards to what you were doing. Can you tell me about that?
At first, they were very suspicious whatever I did. Over time, they found that what I did would bring harmonious situation in prison. The police officers were very nervous about it. But over time, they found, you know, those who came to my Bible study did not engage fights with each other. It is so easy for inmates to fight against each other for, you know, even a very small reason. If you were the police officer on duty that day, things like that took place, the police officer would get punished by higher authorities. So they found that if they let me to do whatever I want to do in terms of teaching these inmates, the whole situation will become much, much more harmonious. When they were on duty, nothing serious would happen. So in that way, I helped them a lot.
In adopting this attitude, this pragmatic approach that sounds like it's benefiting everyone, maybe prison officers in the Western world can learn from their Chinese counterparts. Craig Minogue is serving 23 years in a jail in Victoria, Australia, after being convicted of bombing Melbourne's main police station, killing a constable. He expects to be released by 2016. Coming into the jail illiterate, he's now doing a doctorate, the first prisoner in Australia and one of the few in the world to do so. So he's a very bright man with hard-learned experience of Australia's criminal justice system and government bureaucracies. Knowledge that can assist his fellow prisoners, that is, if prison authorities let him. He's recently written an essay about the subtle and not so subtle ways that the prison bureaucracy bucks when it finds out that Craig's lent a helping hand. Here's some of what he's written.
I live in Victoria's prison system. Over 90% of the people here have not completed primary or secondary schooling. Over 97% have no technical, trade, tertiary or other secondary qualifications. Over 70% suffer from public health problem called drug addiction, and 9% commit acts of self-mutilation or attempt suicide in prison. Many suffer from a diagnosable mental illness, and most are not treated. I've survived in prison since 1986. I completed an arts degree with honours a few years ago, and am now working on my doctorate in applied ethics. I have the knowledge, skills, and resources to help these prisoners with their many legal and personal problems. But why should I? What's it got to do with me? This is a question put to me by prison staff and managers, the ombudsman and lawyers when I try. They say, is there not the judiciary, legal aid services, statutory accountability mechanisms, common law rights, human rights and various NGOs overseeing the observance of the rule of law and the principle of equality before the law? I answer, yes, there are, but all too often they are ineffective or inaccessible. Perhaps the judiciary is deferential to the other instruments of state power to the point of willful blindness. Perhaps legal aid services and statutory accountability mechanisms are underfunded to the point they cannot properly fulfil their role. Perhaps civil liberties and human rights don't really apply to stigmatised prisoners like they do to a popular cause like refugees. Perhaps the NGOs are so overwhelmed that a kind of inertia has set in despite their good intentions. So what should I do? Let me give an example. The Department of Immigration and Citizenship threatens to deport a man who is in prison for criminal offences. The letter is sent to the wrong prison, and by the time the man receives the misdirected letter, the deadline to respond is 2 days away. The Department of Immigration letter also advises the man that he can obtain legal advice from Victoria's Legal Aid, which visits the prison he is no longer at. They even specify the date of the visits each week. Apart from the fact that the man is at a different prison and the letter has been ping-ponging its way around the state for the past 2 weeks, it's important to realise that Victoria's Legal Aid does not fund such matters, and the Department of Immigration must know this. So the suggestion, if acted upon, would be a demoralising waste of the prisoner's time and effort. It's left to me to explain this to the man. Or he could wait for a fortnight for legal aid to visit the prison and tell him the same thing. So I get a 60-day extension from the Department of Immigration after complaining under the cover of a letter in the man's name that they've sent the letter to the wrong prison and deliberately mislead him in relation to obtaining legal advice from legal aid. Then I write, on behalf of the man, to the Public Interest Clearinghouse and their Human Rights Law Resource Centre and ask for assistance. The Resource Centre does not respond. Rather, they redirect the letter to the Victorian Bar Legal Assistance Scheme. The Victorian Bar responds about 7 days later, and they advise that they do not help people at the first stage of an immigration case like this, but will assist at a later appeal. It's then left to me again to explain to the man how this is a hollow offer. Perhaps the solicitor who had assisted the man's brother with the same Department of Correction situation could help. But no, the lawyer who's helped the man's brother is on leave looking after a sick family member. So, how about the overwhelmed Refugee and Immigration Legal Centre providing assistance? Yes, they will help, but it takes 45 days to get that answer, by which time the extraordinary 60-day extension is coming to an end. The Legal Centre will only take the matter on if there's a further extension. If an extension is granted, then the responsibility for this man and his family is all mine, again. Just 5 days from the deadline, we hear that an extension has been granted. I managed to put all the man's legal matters in order so that lawyers are acting on well-prepared briefs and detailed instructions. A lot of private information passes between myself and the man who I'm helping. So a personal connection and a relationship is developed. I feel that it would be irresponsible of me to abandon that person when they still need emotional support. Once a prisoner properly engages with any aspect of not only the legal system, but also the health or social system, faxes, phone calls and photocopies need to be facilitated by prison staff. The vast majority of men do not know that the staff can and should help, so the staff use this ignorance to fob people off until their lives go completely down the drain, and in despair, they start medicating or acting out with violence. So when I became involved in assisting a particular man, the unit staff and the records officer have to do the work that they're supposed to do, and here it comes. They know when I'm advising a particular man that he can send a fax, as I've provided him with the relevant documents. Documents that the staff are hiding from prisoners. They know that I'm informing him that he can be put on the phone in the staff office for Department of Immigration Matters. And here comes what you ask. A reminder is needed about where I am and that this is an institution that's by its very nature closed, secretive and insular. So no formal indictment will arrive and rarely anything will be directly said. Instead, offhand comments from staff and management start to filter back to me. Comments are made to other prisoners about your lawyer mate making work for people. After surviving in prison for almost 22 years, and survival is not a given, after this many years of my resistance against them and their resistance against me, I can say with a good degree of certainty what's going through their minds. And that is, who does this bastard think he is? What's it got to do with him? Now I'm under the correctional gun, and the man I'm helping is also under the gun. In prison, survival depends on being aware of the people who surround you and then predicting how they're going to act from one moment to the next. And the longer you survive, the more aware you need to be. In short, I've been here long enough to be able to hear the correctional wheels turning in their heads, and they go something like this. This one prisoner helping another. Gee, I don't know. It could be an offence of trafficking in information under Corrections Regulation 1998, Regulation 44(1)(d). Or perhaps it's a disruptive act under Regulation 44(b), and it's disrupting our coffee and newspaper reading time. Or perhaps it's an act contrary to the good order, management and security of the prison under Regulation 44(1)(o). The fact is that if it were not for me, this man's voice would not be heard by the Department of Corrections in relation to his possible deportation and the subsequent disintegration of his family, which includes children. What I'm doing is helping the man to communicate in the appropriate way from a position informed by an understanding of natural justice, procedural fairness, and what should be legitimately expected of decision makers and public servants acting reasonably. Most of my fellow prisoners do not ask for help, as most of them are so disenfranchised as citizens, as members of the community, or even as human beings, that they do not feel as if they can speak up for themselves or stand up for themselves without being further beaten down. So, they do nothing to help themselves. What they do is harm themselves by self-medicating and acting out in frustration. And this means that their situation becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The correctional system comes down hard on them for their inappropriate behaviour, and their disenfranchised worldview is brutally reinforced in punishment and isolation cells. When those very few poorly educated and marginalised people who have a scintilla of self-respect left come to me and ask for help with a significant matter, I feel that I have a moral responsibility to help. But I do not have any formal training. My books are all way out of date as I cannot afford the subscriptions, and I am derided as a jailhouse lawyer, a term that I may wear with pride, but it is one which is a pejorative nonetheless. What then is a responsible person expected to do? What the prison system would like me to do is to have a selfish attitude and let the others around me sink or swim in relation to their human dignity and their rights at law being respected. Even some of my fellow prisoners resent the shelves of books in the cell as they represent knowledge and an aspect of civil society from which they're excluded. Some prisoners deride me as a pointless agitator as they feel if we all kept our heads down, they wouldn't take anything more off us. But on the other hand, every day, prisoners and staff ask me for advice about the prison system, the law, and other issues. If considering the interests of the people around me is wrong, if feeling empathy for the difficulties that poorly educated, vulnerable, and marginalised people have got themselves into, and then acting to help when I have the knowledge, skills, and resources to help is wrong, if my being a jailhouse lawyer is wrong, then I have a real problem, because I've taken the wrong lesson from the last 22 years of my sentence. Or perhaps I've not taken the wrong lesson from my experience after all. Perhaps I have got it right, and the prison and legal systems are just another one of those contradictions between form and content, and they are in the wrong.
That was a friend of the program, Colm McNaughton, reading an essay by Craig Minogue, who's presently serving time in jail in Victoria, Australia. You can read more about what Craig has to say on the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. And time to say goodbye to Dr. Yong Jung Lee, our co-host today, an international advocate for free speech, Freedom of Association and Peace, released from a Chinese jail in April last year after a five-year term. Dr. Yung, it was a privilege and a pleasure to have you on the program today. Thank you so much for talking with us. You're just about to engage in a walk from your home in Boston, where you are now, and we've heard the sounds of your home life in the background as you've been speaking today, to Washington. Dr. Yung, that's a very long way. What do you hope to achieve in this walk?
I want to raise awareness of human rights situation in the run-up to Olympic Games in Beijing this summer. There is ongoing violations of human rights in China, which is incompatible with such a great event as Olympic Games.
Good luck, go well, go safely, and thank you so much for talking with us today, Dr. Yung. Please do join us again.
Thank you very much, Chris. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series. In the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD is called Lumiere, performed by one of this show's favourite artists, Bob Brosman. This is an amazing CD, combining musical influences of a range of Asian and Pacific countries. Bob and his colleague Rene LaSalle are also the mastermind musicians of our theme song, Dig Dig, which you're just about to hear now. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders, if you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website's where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. Today's associate producer is Eleanor McInerney. I'm Chris Richards. Let's talk again next week.